It is folly and pride. The witches have lured you into their trap. You must pray with me. My mind is made up, Rabbi. I've seen the wisdom of this. The Bene Gesserits will have their tanks. They will find their volunteers. Consider all the other women aboard, younger and stronger by far. They have their futures ahead of them, while I have had countless lives inside my head. That is more than enough for any person, and I am content. By offering myself, I save someone else. You will be cursed! His hoarse voice cracked before it could rise to a scream. She wondered if he would tear his sleeve and cast her out, disavowing any further connection with her. Right now, the rabbi was too horrified by what she had told him. As you so often remind me, Rabbi, I have millions already within me. In all my pasts, a great many of them were devout Jews. Others followed their own conscience. But make no mistake, this is a price I can willingly pay. An honorable price. Don't think about losing me. Think instead of the girl I am saving. Grasping at straws, he said, "You are too old. You are past childbearing years. My body only needs to provide the incubator, not the ovaries. I have already been tested. The sisters assure me that I can adequately serve." She rested her hand on his arm, knowing that he cared for her. "You were a souk doctor once. I trust the Bene Gesserit physicians. But I would feel better if I knew that you would also watch over me." I... She went to the door of the temple chamber and gave him a last smile. "Thank you, Rabbi." She slipped away before he could marshal his scrambled thoughts and continue arguing with her. To the loving eye, even an abomination can be a beautiful child. Missionaria Protectiva, adapted from the Azar book. For months, under the stern and watchful eyes of the honored Matres, Uxtal worked at monitoring the axolotl tank while also attending the pain laboratories. He felt wrung out in his struggle to satisfy those who controlled him. Crone had come to visit him twice in the past half year, twice that he knew about, though a face dancer could move unnoticed whenever he liked. In his squalid quarters, the lost Tleilaxu researcher kept his own calendar, marking off each day as a small victory, as if survival itself were a matter of keeping score. In the meantime, he had also begun to produce enough of the orange melange alternative to make the whores believe he had value to them after all. Unfortunately, his successes were more a result of repeated attempts than any genuine skill on his part. In spite of his uncertainties and hastily covered blunders, Uxtal had stumbled upon a serviceable manufacturing method. Though inefficient, it was good enough to keep the whores from killing him, for the time being. And meanwhile, the Gola baby continued to grow. When the male fetus reached a point where he could take samples sufficient to run analyses, he compared the DNA to genetic records that Crone had provided. He still didn't know what the face dancers had in mind with this child. In fact, he wasn't even convinced the shapeshifters had a plan at all, beyond their own curiosity. Initially, Uxtal was able to isolate the general bloodline, then narrow it down to specifics: a planet of origin, an extended family, and then a definite family. Finally, he backtracked the lineage to a specific historical person. The result startled him, and he nearly deleted the answer before anyone could see. But he was sure someone must be observing him, and if he was caught trying to hide information, the honored Matres would treat him very harshly. Instead, he faced his own dizzying questions. Why had the old Tliloxu masters preserved those particular cells? What possible purpose could they have imagined? And what other remarkable cells had been inside the destroyed null entropy capsule? Too bad the honored Matres had destroyed all the bodies, burning them or feeding them to sligs. Crone would return soon enough. Then maybe the face dancers would take their Gola baby and Uxtal could be free. Or maybe they would just kill him and be done with it. After its carefully monitored gestation period, the decanting of the infant was imminent. Quite imminent. Uxtal spent most of his days now in the axolotl room, both fearful and fascinated. He bent over the bloated female tank, testing the unborn baby's heartbeats, his movements. The child frequently let loose vicious kicks, as if he hated the fleshy cell that contained him. Not surprising, but alarming nevertheless. When the day arrived, Uxtal summoned his assistants. "If the baby is not born healthy, I will send you to the torture wing." He suddenly gasped, remembering other duties, and left the befuddled assistants standing by the pregnant tank as he rushed into the new adjacent laboratory wing. There, among the screams, moans, and a tiny trickle of precursor chemicals for spice alternative, Helica was waiting impatiently for him. For some time she had amused herself by watching the spice harvesting process, but now, seeing Uxtal, she snaked toward him. He averted his eyes, stammered. "I am sorry, Matre Superior. The Gola is about to be born, and I was distracted. I should have ignored all other responsibilities as soon as you arrived." He muttered a silent, frantic prayer that she wouldn't murder him then and there. The face dancers would be quite upset if she killed him before he could decant the child, wouldn't they? When Helica's eyes flashed dangerously orange, he wanted to run. "I do not believe you are sufficiently convinced of your place in this new order, little man. It is time you are bonded, before that Gola is born. I need to rely on you. You will never again lose track of your priorities." Uxtal became more aware of the swell of her breasts and the way she moved in the tight leotard. She seemed to project a hypnotic sexuality. Their gazes locked, but he experienced no arousal. "Once I make you dependent on my pleasures," she continued, massaging his face gently with her fingers, "I will have your full dedication to my project. With the Gola baby out of the way, you will have no other excuses." Uxtal felt his pulse accelerate. What would she do to him once she found out what Crone had done? A shout came from the main laboratory, followed by the brief, indignant squall of a baby. Uxtal's heart leapt into his throat. "The child has been born. How could they do it without me?" Uxtal tried to pull away from Helica. Terrified that his assistants had proved they could do their work independently, he didn't dare let anyone believe he might be unnecessary. "Please, Matre Superior, let me make certain my foolish assistants did nothing wrong." Fortunately, Helica seemed as interested as he was. The Tliloxu man scuttled out of the new wing and rushed to the now deflated axolotl tank. With a shy but confused smile, one of the assistants held up the dripping, apparently healthy infant by one foot. The Matre Superior strode over, her cape fluttering behind her. Uxtal snatched the baby from the assistant, though he found the whole birthing process disgusting. He was sure that Crone would kill him, and slowly, if he allowed anything to happen to this child. He showed the infant to Helica. "There, Matre Superior. As you see, this distracting job will be over as soon as the face dancers take the child away. My work for them is done. I can now devote much more of my time and energy to creating the orange spice you want so much. Unless you would just like to let me go free?" He raised his eyebrows pleadingly. She gave a dismissive sniff and stalked back into the new wing, where sounds of screaming echoed through the corridors. Uxtal stared down at the newborn boy, amazed at his own luck. By some miraculous numerical alignment, he had achieved success. Now Crone could not complain or punish him. A quiver of dread shuddered down his spine. What if the face dancers insisted that he restore the Gola's memories as well? So many more years. Seeing the newborn now, so simple, innocent, and normal, puzzled Uxtal. Having reviewed the historical records, he couldn't imagine what this Gola's destiny would be, what Crone would do with him. It must be part of a cosmic plan that he could understand, but only if he ascertained all the numbers that pointed to the truth. He held the Gola baby out before him, looked at the tiny face, and shook his head. "Welcome back, Baron Vladimir Harkonnen." 6 years after escape from Chapter House. We all have a beast within us, hungry and violent. Some of us can feed and control the predator within, but it is unpredictable when unleashed. Reverend Mother Shiana, Ithaca Logs. Mulling over her duties and dilemmas, Shiana walked alone down quiet and isolated passageways. Now that the Gola resurrection program had been decided upon, the long wait had begun. After a year and a half of preparations, 3 more axolotl tanks were ready, bringing the total to 5. The first of the precious embryos now gestated inside one of the new augmented wombs. Soon, the near-mythical figures from history would return. The Tleilaxu master Saitel eagerly attended to the axolotl tanks, utterly committed to ensuring that the first ones turned out perfectly so that Shiana would allow him to create a Gola of himself. Since the little man had so much to gain from the success of the process, she trusted him, to a certain extent, and only for the time being. No one knew what the enemy wanted or why they were so interested in this particular no-ship. One must understand an enemy to fight that enemy, the first incarnation of Bashar Miles Teg had once written. And she thought, we know nothing about this old man and woman that only Duncan can see. Who do they represent? What do they want? Preoccupied, she continued to walk the lower decks. During their years on the Ithaca, Duncan Idaho had kept an anxious watch outside, searching for any sign of the enemy's endlessly questing net. The ship seemed to have remained safe since the narrow escape more than 2 years ago. Maybe she and the other passengers were safe after all. Maybe. As month after month of daily routine passed without any overt threat, Shiana had to remind herself to fight against complacency, against the natural tendency to grow soft. Through the lessons in other memory, especially in her Atreides bloodline, she knew the perils of lowering her guard. Bene Gesserit's senses should always be alert for subtle dangers. Shiana stopped in mid-step in an isolated corridor. She froze as a scent touched her nostrils, a wild animal odor that did not belong in the processed and air-conditioned corridors. It was mixed with a coppery smell. Blood. A primal inner sense told her she was being watched, and perhaps even stalked. The invisible gaze burned like a laser gun against her skin. Goosebumps prickled the back of her neck. Realizing that this was a precarious moment, she moved slowly, holding out her hands and spreading her fingers, partly in a placating gesture, partly in preparation for hand-to-hand combat. The no-ship's winding corridors were wide enough to accommodate the movement of heavy machinery, such as Guild Navigator tanks. Built out in the scattering, much of the vessel's design was driven by needs and pressures that were no longer relevant. Support struts curved overhead like the ribs of a huge prehistoric beast. Adjoining passages plunged off at angles. Storage chambers and unoccupied quarters were dark, and most of the doors to the main passenger areas were sealed but not locked. With only their own refugees aboard, the escaping Bene Gesserits rarely felt the need for locks. But something was here. Something dangerous. Inside her head, the voices from Shiana's past clamored for her to be careful, then backed off into necessary mental silence so that she could concentrate. She sniffed the air, took two steps farther down the hall, and stopped as the warning instinct grew more potent. Danger here. One of the storeroom doors was dark and almost closed, but not quite sealed. The tiny crack was just wide enough that an observer hiding within could keep watch on anyone who passed by. There. That was where the scent of blood came from, and a rank, musky animal smell. Intent on her discovery, she could not hide her reaction. The door burst open, and a muscular dynamo stood there naked, pale flesh dusted with reddish-brown hair, a mouth widened to accommodate thick, tearing fangs. The muscles beneath the tight skin were as tight as coiled sugar wire. One of the Futars. His curved claws and dark lips were stained with a bright splash of fresh blood. With all the force of voice she could put behind a single word, Shiana snapped, "Stop!" The Futar froze as if a leash around his neck had suddenly been yanked taut. In the bright corridor light, Shiana stood motionless, non-threatening. The creature glared at her, his lips drawn back to expose long teeth. She used voice again, though she was aware that these creatures might have been bred to resist known Bene Gesserit skills. Shiana cursed herself for not spending more time studying the beasts to understand their motivations and vulnerabilities. Do not harm me. The Futar remained poised for attack, a bomb ready to explode. You handler. He took a deep sniff. Not handler. In the dim storeroom that the Futar had chosen for his den, Shiana caught a glimpse of white flesh and torn dark robes. She saw pale fingers curled toward the ceiling, loose in a repose of death. Who had it been? Until now, the four captive Futars had been surly and restless, but not murderous. Even when they had been held prisoner by the honored Matres, their natural prey, they had not killed the whores, because apparently they would not act without instructions from their true masters. Handlers. But after their rough treatment by the honored Matres, and then years of being held in the brig of the no-ship, could the Futars be breaking down? Even the harshest inbred training could grow fuzzy around the edges, allowing accidents. Shiana focused on her adversary, forcing herself not to see the creature as something unstable or broken. Don't underestimate him. At the moment, she could not concern herself with how the creature had escaped from its high-security brig cell. Had all four broken free to roam the halls, or was this the only one? In a careful gesture, she lifted her chin and turned her head to one side, baring her throat. A natural predator would understand the universal signal of submission. The Futar's need for dominance, to be the leader of a pack, required him to accept the gesture. You are a Futar, Shiana said. I am not one of your old handlers. He crept forward to draw a deep sniff. Not honored Matre, either. He growled, a low, bubbling sound that demonstrated his hatred for the whores who had enslaved him and his comrades. But Bene Gesserit's sisters were something else entirely. Even so, he had killed one. We are your caretakers now. We give you food. Food. The Futar licked blood from his dark lips. You asked us for sanctuary on Gamu. We rescued you from the honored Matres. Bad women. But we are not bad. Shiana remained motionless, non-threatening, facing the coiled danger of the Futar. As a child, she had confronted a giant sandworm and shouted at it, heedless of her peril. She could do this. She made her voice as soothing as possible. I am Shiana. She spoke in a lilting, hushed voice. Do you have a name? The creature growled. At least she thought it was a growl. Then she realized that the confined rumble in his larynx was actually his name. Herm. Herm. Do you recall when you came to this no-ship? When you escaped from the honored Matres? You asked us to take you away. Bad women, the Futar said again. Yes. And we saved you. Shiana edged closer. Though she wasn't entirely sure of its efficacy, she controlled her body chemistry to increase her scent, trying to match some of the markers exuded by the Futar's musk glands. She made sure he smelled that she was female, not a threat. Something to protect, not attack. She was also careful not to give off any odor of fear, to keep this predator from thinking of her as its prey. You shouldn't have escaped from your room. Want handlers. Want home. With a longing in his feral eyes, Herm glanced back at the dark storage room where the torn body of the hapless sister lay. Shiana wondered how long Herm had been feeding on the corpse. I need to take you back to the other Futars. You must stay together. We protect you. We are your friends. You must not hurt us. Herm grumbled. Then, taking a big chance, Shiana reached out and touched his hairy shoulder. The Futar stiffened, but she stroked carefully, seeking pleasure centers along his vivid nerves. Though startled by her attentions, Herm did not draw away. Her hands drifted upward, moving with a gentle intensity. Shiana touched Herm's neck, then behind his ears. The Futar's suspicious growl became a sound more like a purr. We are your friends, she insisted, applying just a hint of voice to reinforce it. You should not hurt us. She looked meaningfully into the den chamber at the dead sister on the floor. Herm stiffened. My kill. You should not have killed. That is not an honored Matre. She was one of my sisters. She was one of your friends. Futars should not kill friends. Shiana stroked him again, and his coarse body hair bristled. She began to lead him down the corridor. We feed you. There is no need for you to kill. Kill honored Matres. There are no honored Matres on this ship. We hate them too. Need to hunt. Need handlers. You can't have either right now. Someday? Herm sounded hopeful. Someday. Shiana could make no more of a promise than that. She took him away from the dead Bene Gesserit, hoping the two of them would encounter no one else on the way back to the brig, no other potential victims. Her hold on this creature was far too tenuous. If Herm was startled, he might attack. She took side passages and service lifts that few others would use until they arrived at the deep brig level. The Futar seemed disconsolate, reluctant to go back into his cell, and she pitied him his endless confinement, just like the 7 sandworms in the hold. Reaching the door, she saw that a minor security circuit had failed after so many years. At first, she had dreaded a systemic problem and expected to find all the Futars loose. Instead, this proved to be a minor glitch resulting from poor maintenance procedures. An accident on an old vessel. The year before, there had been another breakdown involving a water recycling reservoir when a corroded pipe flooded a corridor. They had also experienced recurring problems with the algae vats that were used for food and oxygen production. Maintenance was growing lax. Complacent. Shiana controlled her anger, not wanting Herm to smell it on her. Though the Bene Gesserits lived in constant, intangible peril, the danger no longer seemed immediate. She had to impose much stricter discipline from now on. A breakdown like this could have led to disaster. Herm looked saddened and beaten as he shuffled into the confinement chamber. You must stay in there, Shiana said, trying to sound encouraging. At least for a while longer. Want home, Herm said. I will try to find your home. But right now, I have to keep you safe. Herm plodded to the far wall of the brig chamber and squatted on his haunches. The other 3 Futars approached the barriers of their separate cells to peer out with hungry, curious eyes. Fixing the door shield mechanism was a simple thing. Now all would be safe, Futars and Bene Gesserits. Shiana feared for them, though. Wandering aimlessly in the no-ship, her people had been too long without a goal. That would have to change. Perhaps the birth of the new Golas would give them what they needed. To the sisterhood, other memory is one of the greatest blessings and greatest mysteries. We understand only shadows of the process by which lives are transferred from one reverend mother to another. That vast reservoir of voices from the past is a brilliant but mysterious light. Reverend Mother Darwy O'Drade. Over the course of 2 years, the new sisterhood had started to become a single unified organism, and all the while the planet of Chapter House continued to die. Mother Commander Mirbella walked briskly through the brown orchards. One day this would all be desert. On purpose. As part of the plan to create an alternative to Rakkus, Sandtrout worked furiously to encapsulate water. The arid belt expanded, and now only the hardiest apple trees with the deepest roots clung to life. Nevertheless, the orchard was one of Mirbella's favorite places, a joy she had learned from Odraed, her captor, teacher, and, eventually, respected mentor. It was mid-afternoon, and sunlight filtered through the sparse leaves and brittle branches. Even so, it was a cool day, with a stiff breeze from the north. She paused and bowed her head out of respect for the woman who lay buried beneath a small Macintosh apple tree, which struggled to grow even as the environment wasted into harsh aridity. No brass plaque identified the Mother Superior's resting place. Though honored Matres preferred ostentation and dramatic memorials, Odraed would have been appalled by any such gesture. Mirbella wished her predecessor could have lived long enough to see the results of her great plan of synthesis. Honored Matres and Bene Gesserits living together on Chapter House. The groups had learned from their differences, drawing strength from each other. But renegade honored Matres on outside planets continued to be a thorn in her side, refusing to join the new sisterhood, causing turmoil while the Mother Commander needed to face the much larger threat of the outside enemy. Those women rejected her as their leader, saying that she had tainted and diluted their ways. They wanted to wipe out Mirbella and her followers to the last sister. And some of those rebels might still have their terrible obliterators, though certainly not many, or they would have used them by now. When her newly formed group of fighters completed their training, Mirbella intended to seize the renegades and bring them into the fold before it was too late. The new sisterhood would eventually have to go up against large contingents of honored Matre holdouts on Boozle, Gamu, Tlilox, and other worlds. We must break them and assimilate them, she thought. But first, we must be certain of our unity. Bending down, Mirbella scooped up a handful of dirt near the base of the small tree. Holding the dry soil in the palm of her hand, she lifted it to her nose and inhaled the pungent, earthy aroma. At times, she wondered if she could detect ever so faintly the infinitesimal scent of her mentor and friend. Someday I may join you here, she said aloud, looking at the struggling tree. But not yet. First, I have important work to finish. Your legacy, murmured Odraed within. Our legacy. You inspired me to heal the factions and bring together women who were mortal enemies. I didn't expect it to be so hard or to take so long. In her head, Odraed remained silent. Mirbella walked farther from the fortress-like keep, putting it behind her and all of her responsibilities with it. She identified the passing rows of dying trees. Apples giving way to peaches, cherries, and oranges. She decided to order an active program of planting date palms, which would survive longer in the changing climate. But did they even have years? Climbing a nearby hill, she noted how much harder and drier the soil was. In grasslands beyond the orchards, the sisterhood's cattle still grazed, but the pasture was sparse now, forcing the animals to range farther. She saw the flicker of a lizard running across the warm ground. Sensing danger, the tiny reptile scurried up a large stone to look back at her. Suddenly, a desert hawk swooped down, snatched the creature, and carried it into the sky. Mirbella responded with a hard smile. For some time now, the desert had been approaching, killing all growing things in its path. Wind-blown dust painted the normally blue skies with a constant brownish haze. As the sandworms grew out in the arid belt, so did their desert to accommodate them. an ever-expanding ecosystem. In the encroaching desert ahead of her and the faltering orchards behind her, Mirbella saw two great Bene Gesserit dreams crashing into one another like opposing tides, a beginning absorbing an ending. Long before Shiana brought a single aging sandworm here, the sisterhood planted this orchard. The new plan, however, had far greater galactic importance than any symbolism represented by the orchard graveyards. Through their bold action, the Bene Gesserit order had saved the sandworms and melange before the ravages of the honored Matres. Wasn't that worth the loss of a few fruit trees? Melange was both a blessing and a curse. She turned and strode back to the keep. The conscious mind is only the tip of the iceberg. A vast mass of subconscious thoughts and latent abilities lies beneath the surface. The Mentat Handbook. Back when Duncan Idaho was held prisoner at the Chapter House spaceport, enough deadly mines had been placed on the no-ship to destroy it three times over. O'Drade and Belanda had planted the explosives throughout the grounded no-ship, ready to be triggered should Duncan try to escape. They had assumed that the deadly mines would be a sufficient deterrent. The loyal sisters had never dreamed that Shiana herself and her conservative allies might deactivate those mines and steal the ship for their own purposes. The passengers aboard the Ithaca were theoretically trustworthy, but Duncan, staunchly supported by the Bashar, insisted that these mines were simply too dangerous to leave unprotected. Only he, Teg, Shiana, and four others had direct access to the armory. During his routine check, Duncan unsealed the vault and viewed the wide selection of weapons. He drew reassurance from observing his options, tallying the ways that the Ithaca could fight back should it ever become necessary. He sensed that the old man and woman had not stopped searching, though he had not encountered the shimmering net for 3 years now. He could not let his guard down. He inspected rows of modified laser guns, pulse rifles, splinter guns, and projectile launchers. These weapons represented an edgy potential for violence that made him think of honored Matres. The whores would not want distant and impersonal stunners. They preferred weapons that caused extreme damage up close, where they could see the carnage and smile. He had already gained far too much insight into their tastes when he'd discovered the sealed torture chamber. He wondered what else the terrible women might have hidden aboard the great vessel. For the entire time Duncan had been a prisoner aboard the grounded no-ship, these weapons had been stored here, securely locked but still within reach. Had he wanted to, he surely could have broken into the armory and stolen them. He was surprised that O'Drade had underestimated him, or trusted him. In the end, she had given him what history called the Atreides choice, explaining the consequences and allowing him to decide whether or not to stay with the no-ship. She trusted his loyalties. Anyone who knew him, either personally or from history, understood that Duncan Idaho and loyalty were synonymous. Now, he considered the compact, sealed mines that had been meant to bring the no-ship down in a flaming collapse. A failsafe. Those aren't the only ticking bombs aboard this ship. The voice startled him, and he spun about, instinctively assuming a fighting stance. Dour, curly-haired Garimi stood at the hatch. In spite of all his experience with them, Duncan was still astonished by how silently the damned witches could move. Duncan struggled to regain his composure. Is there another armory? A secret stash of weapons? It was possible, he supposed, given the thousands of chambers aboard the giant ship that had never been opened or searched. I was speaking metaphorically. I meant those Golas from the past. That has already been discussed and decided. In the medical center, the first Gola from Cytale's sample cells would soon be decanted. Simply making a decision does not make the decision correct, Garimi said. You harp on it too much. Garimi rolled her eyes. Even you haven't seen any sign of your hunters since the day we consigned our 5 tortured sisters to space. It's time for us to find a suitable world and establish a new core for the Bene Gesserit sisterhood. Duncan frowned. The Oracle of Time also said the hunters were searching for us. Another encounter that only you experienced. Are you suggesting I imagined it? Or that I'm lying? Bring me any truthsayer you like. I will prove it to you. She grumbled. Even so, it has been years since the Oracle purportedly warned you. We have eluded capture all this time. Leaning against one of the shelves of weapons, Duncan gave her a cool stare. And how do you know the enemy isn't patient? That they won't just wait for us to make a mistake. They want this ship, or they want someone aboard it. Probably me. Once these new Golas regain their knowledge and experience, they may be our greatest advantage. Or an unrecognized danger. He realized he would never convince her. I knew Paul Atreides. As the Atreides Swordmaster, I helped to raise and train that boy. I will do so again. He became the terrible Muad'Dib. He began a jihad that slaughtered trillions, and he turned into an emperor as corrupt as any in history before him. He was a good child and a good man, Duncan insisted. And while he shaped the map of history, Paul was himself shaped by the events around him. Even so, in the end, he refused to follow the path that he knew led to so much pain and ruin. His son Leto did not have such reservations. Leto II was forced into a Hobson's choice of his own. We cannot judge that decision until we know everything that was behind it. Perhaps not enough time has passed for anyone to say whether or not his choice was ultimately correct. A storm of anger crossed Garimi's face. It's been 5,000 years since the tyrant began his work. 1,500 years since his death. One of his most prominent lessons was that humanity should learn to think on a truly long timescale. Uncomfortable with allowing the Bene Gesserit woman so close to so many tempting weapons, he eased her back out into the corridor and sealed the vault door. I was on Ix, fighting the Tleilaxu for House Vernius when Paul Atreides was born in the Imperial Palace on Catane. I found myself embroiled in the first battles of the War of Assassins that consumed House Ikaz and Duke Leto for so many years. Lady Jessica had been summoned to Catane for the last months of her pregnancy because Lady Honorul suspected the potential of Paul and wanted to be present at the birth. Despite treachery and assassinations, the baby survived and was brought back to Caladan. Garimi stepped away from the armory, still obviously disturbed. According to the legends, Paul Muad'Dib was born on Caladan, not on Catane. Legends are just that, sometimes fraught with errors, sometimes distorted intentionally. As an infant, Paul Atreides was christened on Caladan, and he considered that planet his home until his arrival on Dune. You Bene Gesserits wrote that history. And now you plan to rewrite it with what you assure us is the truth? With your precious Paul and other Gola children from the past? Not rewrite it. We intend to recreate it. clearly dissatisfied, but seeing that any further argument would simply carry them in circles, Garimi waited to see which direction Duncan would walk. Then she turned the opposite way and stalked off. The unknown can be a terrible thing, and is often made more monstrous by human imagination. The real enemy, however, may be far worse than any we can possibly imagine. Do not let your guard down. Mother Superior Darwy O'Drade. The fat Reverend Mother and the feral Honored Matre stood stiffly together, as far apart as they thought they could without being too obvious. Even an observer without specialized Bene Gesserit training would have noticed their dislike for each other. You two will have to work together. Mirbella's voice allowed for no argument. I have decided that we must devote more of our efforts to the desert belt. Never forget that Melange is the key. We will call in outside researchers to set up observation bases out in the deepest worm territories. Maybe we can find a few old experts who actually visited Rakkas before it was destroyed. Our Melange stockpiles are still significant, Belanda pointed out. And the sand trout seem to be destroying all fertile land, Doria added. The flow of spice is secure. Nothing is ever secure. Complacency can be a worse threat than the rebelled Honored Matres themselves. Or the outside enemy, Mirbella said. To oppose either adversary, we must have the absolute cooperation of the Spacing Guild. We need their immense ships, fully armed, to transport us to and from anywhere we choose. We can use the Guild and Chome as carrot and stick to force planets, governments, and independent military systems to follow our lead. For that, our most effective tool is Melange. With no other source, they will have to come to us for spice. Or they can fly other ships from the scattering, Belanda said. Doria snorted. The Guild would never stoop to that. With a sideways glance at her rival and partner, Belanda added, Because we only let the Guild obtain small amounts of spice from us, they also pay exorbitant prices for black market melange from other stockpiles. Once we force them to exhaust their spice supplies, we will bring the Guild to its knees and they will do whatever we ask of them. Belanda nodded. The Guild is probably desperate already. When Administrator Goris and the Navigator Edric came here 3 years ago, they were nearly frantic. We have kept them on a tight leash since then. They could well be on the verge of irrational action, Doria warned. The spice must flow, but only on our terms. Mirbella turned to the women. I have a new assignment for you two. When we offer our generous forgiveness in exchange for guild cooperation in the coming war, we'll need to be extravagant in our payment. Doria and Belanda, I place you in charge of managing the arid zone, the spice extraction process, and the new sandworms. Belanda looked shocked. Mother Commander, could I not serve you better here? As your advisor and guardian? No, you could not. As a mentor, you have shown great skill in handling details, and Doria has the edge to push where it is needed. Make sure our sandworms produce spice in the quantities we and the Guild will need. From now on, the deserts of Chapter House are your responsibility. After the unlikely pair left for the desert, Mirbella went to see the old archive's Mother Acadia, still seeking essential answers. In a large and airy wing of Chapter House Keep, the ancient librarian had arranged numerous tables and booths where thousands of reverend mothers toiled. Under normal circumstances, the keep's archives would have been a quiet place for study and meditation, but Acadia had taken on a special mission that gave the new sisterhood a wealth of unexpected hope. The Bene Gesserit library world of Lampadas had been among the many planetary casualties from Honored Matre depredations. Knowing their imminent fate, the doomed women had shared among each other, distilling the experience and knowledge of an entire population into only a few representatives. Eventually, all of those memories and the entire library of Lampadas had been placed in the mind of the wild Reverend Mother Rebecca, who had managed to share again with many others, thus saving the memories of all those people. Acadia's grand new scheme was to recreate the lost Lampadas library. She gathered reverend mothers who had obtained the knowledge and experiences of the Lampadas horde. The ones who were mentats were able to remember word for word everything those previous lives had read and learned. The archives wing was a drone of conversation and background noise, women sitting before shigawire spool recorders and dictating from memory, reading aloud page after page of rare books that their experiences recalled. Other women sat with their eyes closed, sketching on crystal sheets the diagrams and designs that were locked away in memory. Mirbella watched volume after volume being recreated before her eyes. Each woman had a specific assignment to reduce the likelihood of duplicating efforts. Acadia seemed content as she greeted her visitor. "Welcome, Mother Commander. With great effort, we are managing to undo more and more losses. I can only hope that the enemy does not obliterate Chapter House and render your efforts in vain. Preserving knowledge is never a pointless exercise, Mother Commander." Mirbella shook her head. "But we don't seem to have certain vital knowledge. Key elements are missing. The simplest, most straightforward information. Who or what is our enemy? Why would they cause such appalling destruction? For that matter, who are the Honored Matres? Where did they come from, and how did they provoke such wrath? You yourself were an Honored Matre. Do your other memories give you no clues?" Mirbella gritted her teeth. She had tried and tried with no success. "I can study the course of the Bene Gesserit lines I have acquired, but not the Honored Matres. Their past is a black wall before my eyes. Each time I delve into it, I reach an impassable barrier. Either the Honored Matres do not know their own origins, or it is such a terrible secret that they have managed to block it completely. I've heard that is true for all of our Honored Matres who have passed through the Spice Agony. Everyone." Mirbella had received the same answer again and again. The origins of the Honored Matres and of the enemy were no more than dim myths in their past. Honored Matres had never been reflective, pondering consequences or tracing events back to first principles. Now, it seemed they would all suffer for it. "You will have to find the information some other way, Mother Commander. If we discover any clues while reproducing the Lampadas library, I will inform you." Mirbella thanked her, yet sensed that the information she needed did not lie here. Shortly before Jeunesse decided to undergo the Spice Agony, 3 years after her twin sister had failed, the Mother Commander went to her room in the Acolyte's barracks. "I deceived myself about Rinya's chances in the ordeal." The words did not come easily to Mirbella. "I never dreamed that a daughter of mine and Duncan's could possibly fail. My old Honored Matre hubris showed itself." "This daughter won't fail, Mother Commander," Jeunesse said, sitting straight. "I have trained hard, and I am as ready as anyone can be. I am frightened, yes, but only enough to maintain my edge. Honored Matres believe there is no place for fear, Mirbella mused. They do not consider that one can be strengthened by admitting weakness, instead of trying to hide it or bulldoze your way over it. If you do not face your weaknesses, how do you know where to be strong? I read that quote in the archival writings of Duncan, Idaho. Over the years, Jeunesse had studied the many lives of Duncan, Idaho. Though she would never meet her father, she had learned much from the combat techniques of the great swordmaster of House Atreides, classic fighting abilities that had been recorded and passed on to others. Setting aside the distraction of Duncan, Mirbella looked down at her oldest surviving daughter. You don't need my help. I can see it in your eyes. Tomorrow, you face the spice agony. She rose and prepared to go. I have been looking for someone whose loyalties and skills I can trust completely. After tomorrow, I believe you will be that person. No land or sea or planet is forever. Wherever we stand, we are only stewards. Mother Superior Darwy O'Drade. Carrying two passengers, the ornithopter flew over the newborn desert and rock formations, heading away from Chapter House Keep. Looking back from her wide seat in the rear compartment, Belanda watched the rings of dying crops and orchards disappear behind the dunes. From the small cabin ahead of her, Doria controlled the aircraft. The brash, former Honored Matre rarely let Belanda pilot a thopter, though she was certainly competent. The two spoke little during their hours of flying. Farther south, the barren regions continued to expand as the planet itself dried up. Over the course of nearly 17 years, the water-hoarding sand trout had drained the large sea, leaving a dust bowl and an ever-widening arid band. Before long, all of Chapter House would become another dune. If any of us survives to see it, Belanda thought, the enemy will find us and all our worlds sooner or later. She was not superstitious nor an alarmist, but the conclusion was a mentat certainty. Both women wore plain black single suits designed for permeability and cooling. Since the student brawl and the assassination attempt at the gathering, Mirbella had made the uniform dress code mandatory across the new sisterhood, no longer allowing the women to flaunt their different origins. During times of peace and prosperity, freedom and diversity are considered absolute rights, Mirbella said. With a monumental crisis facing us, however, such concepts become disruptive and self-indulgent. Every sister on Chapter House now wore a black single suit, without any obvious identifiers of whether she originated from the Honored Matres or Bene Gesserits. Unlike the heavy, concealing Bene Gesserit robes, the fine mesh of the form-fitting fabric hid none of Belanda's lumpy bulk. I look like the Baron Harkonnen, she thought. She felt an odd sort of pleasure whenever the fairly lean Doria looked at her with disgust. The former Honored Matre was in a foul mood because she didn't want to go on this inspection trip, especially not with Belanda. In perverse response, the Reverend Mother made an effort to be overly cheery. No matter how much Belanda tried to deny it, the two of them had similar personalities. Both obstinate and fiercely loyal to their respective factions, yet grudgingly acknowledging the greater purpose of the new sisterhood. Belanda, always quick to notice flaws, had never hesitated to criticize Mother Superior O'Drade either. Doria was similar in her own way, unafraid of pointing out faults in the Honored Matres. Both women tried to hold on to the outdated ways of their respective organizations. As the new spice operations directors, she and Doria shared stewardship of the fledgling desert. Belanda wiped perspiration from her brow. They were almost to the desert, and with each passing moment, the heat outside increased. She raised her voice above the drone of the thopter's wings. "You and I should make the best of this trip, for the good of the Sisterhood." "You make the best of it," Doria shouted her sarcasm. "For the good of the Sisterhood." Belanda grabbed a safety strap as the ornithopter passed through turbulence. "You are mistaken if you think I agree entirely with what the Mother Commander is doing. I never thought her mongrel alliance would survive the first year, much less six." Scowling, Doria steadied the controls. "That does not make us in any way alike." Below, patches of sand and dust swirled, temporarily obscuring the ground. The dunes were encroaching on a line of already dead trees. Comparing the coordinates on a bulkhead screen with her notebook, Belanda estimated that the desert had advanced by almost 50 kilometers in only a few months. More sand meant more territory for the growing worms, and consequently more spice. Mirbella would be pleased. When the air currents smoothed, Belanda spotted an interesting exposed rock formation that had previously been obscured by thick forest. On a sheer side of the rock, she saw a magnificent splash of primitive paintings in red and yellow ochre that had somehow endured the passage of time. She had heard of these ancient sites, supposedly indications of the mysterious, vanished Muadru people from millennia past, but she had never seen evidence of them before. It surprised her that the lost race had reached this obscure planet. What had drawn them all the way out here? Not surprisingly, Doria showed no interest whatsoever in the archaeological oddity. Presently, the aircraft landed on a flat section of rock near one of the first worm observatories Odraid had established. The small, blocky structure towered above them as they disembarked. When the thopter's canopy opened and the two stepped out onto the drifting dunes near Desert Watch Station, Belanda felt perspiration at her temples and in the small of her back,